Hello, welcome to my talk, Rolling Your Own Security Team for Fun and No Profit at All. We will come to that later, why we're focusing on fun. It will be clear at the end. So let's quickly go through the agenda. First, I'm going to talk a little bit about what we actually do as in the Arch Linux security team. Then we will a little bit look into how we got there and take a small look into our security tracker, which is our central platform, and then discuss the core of this talk, basically what we have learned in our journey so far, and finish everything with a small Q&A session. So a little bit about myself. I'm Levente Poyak, and I'm a full-stack software and security engineer and also love DevOps duties. I joined Arch Linux in 2014, and I'm active in a security team, packaging, development, and also DevOps. I've been elected as the Arch Linux project leader in 2020. So let's talk about what we actually do in a security team. So basically, our main goal, our primary value is keeping the Arch users safe. This is what everything is basically about. And if we think about what that means, the main interaction from a user point of view with our distro is software, installing packages, because that's where the software comes from. And you're doing that by pulling the packages from our repositories. So basically, we're responsible to ensure safety for all users by taking care of the safety of our packages. What we on top do is we also consult infrastructure design choices nowadays and also review some configuration related to it. So this is because we also run different services like the AUR and other things, and also own machines that we use in the whole distro process and releases. So it's also equally important to focus on our infrastructure ourselves. And on top, we also coordinate information. What that means is basically, from a user perspective, you see advisories being issued from our side, which basically warns users that there has been a certain update released that fixes some security-related shortcomings. So we also warn about the impact of such problems, so users are aware and can prioritize updates, for example. But also, we coordinate embargoed issues. Embargoed issues, just to summarize it shortly, if you're not familiar with it, it's basically coordinated disclosure where you have upfront information about the security vulnerability that is not yet public. It's just shared across various entities that can prepare updates, review the problem or the fixes that are related to the security issue, and also have a fixed date where this information gets public. So, for example, every distro can, in a timely manner, release updates at the same time. So we also coordinate that with our package maintainers. So we now know what we basically do today, but there is a lot of evolution that led us to get there where we are today. So let's have a quick look into the timeline and basically how we got here. And it was a bit before 2014, but I think January 2014 is a good date to pinpoint some community efforts that were that existed back then. Basically, community members filed bug reports and issues about CVEs, which means CVEs are an identifier for a specific security vulnerability. So a certain issue can be referenced in a uniform way and easily recognizable with an ID and a year. So the community filed bug reports and patches, but there was nothing really structured. We're still very thankful, even up until today, that our community still helps us and files bug reports. So thanks a lot there. But there was some kind of demand for something established, something structural, something persistent. So this led to in March 2014 that Alan basically made a call for action to fund or to found such a security team, and have really something established inside our distro that is dedicated to be responsible for this kind of things. The main focus that Alan wanted to see here was our packages. So this is also, as I explained earlier, basically the main interaction point from a user perspective. And this was what Alan really was looking for. It took until September 2014 until me and Remy basically founded the security team. It was day zero, kind of. We came up with well-defined workflows and structures and also templates for advisories, and really wanted to send out advisories to users. Things like that did not exist before. And this was basically the day zero where this team has been founded. It took over 2 years to finally come up with our own platform to coordinate all the work. So in around December 2016, it was quite specifically December 2016, I still remember it, because I made the big release during the CCC, which is an annual conference at the end of the year. And it helped us streamline all our work. So I will come to that shortly and also show a little bit how it looks like, how we interact with this central platform to coordinate everything which is package related. And this September, we had our sixth birthday, which I'm really proud of. This was a long journey so far, and we evolved quite a lot. And I'm especially proud of it because even though Alan back then made the call for action to have such a security team, once we stepped ahead and said, yeah, now is the time, we are really eager to see this happen and we want to invest time, and we are very passionate about it. He was kind of skeptical and said, like, in 6 months we will be gone. And turns out we are still here, and yeah, we have come to stay, so that's a good thing. All our efforts also led to a lot of visibility and fixes and improvements in our distro. So these numbers are just from our security tracker. Basically, it is a bit higher because I did not count everything that we released and issued before our central platform went live. But so far, we have issued over 880 advisories, and we have released over 1,100 packages with fixes that we tracked that had security vulnerabilities. Well, after this release, they hopefully didn't have those anymore. The discrepancy is here a little bit because sometimes we decide to not issue advisories. This is because our distro is a rolling release, so we only have one version, and we expect users to kind of update in a timely manner, which means if we want to track all fixes for every software that affects our packages, and we do so, hopefully. But sometimes it takes a while, or some issues were discovered or at least made public very far in the future after a release. So for example, if an issue was fixed for 6 months or something like that, and we then track and add the information to our platform, we basically assume that users should have updated within 6 months. So we don't issue advisories if the severity of an issue is, yeah, also not too critical that we say we still want to warn users after such a long period of time. So this is why this difference in the numbers exists. Now let's look a little bit about how our security tracker works. And you can reach it at security.archlinux.org. It helps us keep track of all the information, of all the issues and information related to CVEs and certain open source software. We also use it to track related things like links, change logs, also commits, because we always try to find commits so we can easily verify certain fixes and if they those fixes really made it into a release. Our platform also has a central to-do list, so we have a much more streamlined and easier way to find what we need to do right now, what kind of packages got updates released and things like that. Before our platform, before our central security tracker, we needed to do all this manually, which was a lot of pain. So we're very lucky that we now have a very well-established central platform. I will shortly show some examples how it looks like. Also describe a little bit what we did before we had this platform. It also has it also provides an API for external consumption. Which means, just an example, the data could be pulled out of our tracker to create tools like giving users the ability to correlate the data on our tracker with their local systems, which basically makes it able to warn users that, or make users aware that they have some packages installed which have known vulnerabilities, as well as that there are updates available that fixes certain issues, which was not yet updated on a local machine for a user. The whole tracker is also open source, so open for contribution, and we are also always happy if we can extend it further. So we are inviting everyone to take a look, and if something is missing on the platform, we are happily accepting patches. Let's look a little bit at how it looks like. This is basically the index, the main page, the front page that you will see when you visit our tracker. It lists all the currently open security vulnerabilities. You can also go through all the fixed ones and get also more detailed information. If, for instance, you click on one of the issues, one of the CVEs, you get a very detailed overview, including descriptions, severity, and things like that. It also has cross references, so it shows what kind of packages were affected by an issue, or if they were some advisories already released. This is kind of handy, actually, so makes navigation and collecting information about certain aspects very easy and convenient. From our team perspective, we have a very easy to use form-based input where we can add details to the tracker. Back then, this was not that easy. It was very annoying and cumbersome. I will show in two slides how it looked like. So this is a huge improvement, I can really assure you. We also use all this information to correlate and assemble a final advisory. So it lists all the issues that affected one release, summarizes everything, states which version is the one you need to have installed, at least installed to make to make those issues disappear. And we also have a summary, basically an impact, all the issues, what kind of impact do they have for a user? So it's easier to understand from a user perspective without reading through a wall of text sometimes. What is the actual impact? Why should I update, or can I just delay it a little bit because it does not really affect me or it is not too critical, so I don't need to run home and install updates on all my systems or something like that. And back then, we also created this one manually, so this also gave us a lot of free time. We also have logs, so audit logs, where we can see diff-based changes. So it also makes the work a little bit easier, because if we want to have a discussion about something, for instance, if a severity got raised too high, or one of our members thinks it should really be high, because it affects, I don't know, for example, if it was detected that is not just a local issue, but it is a network facing issue, then you also want to, of course, erase the severity. And sometimes you want to have a discussion about why some data was added in a way like it was. So this helps also to initialize such a discussion and know who entered what kind of data. This is basically how it looks, or what it looked like before we had our central platform. This is a simple wiki that we used. We inserted all the entries manually. We keep track of updated packages manually. We wrote all those advisories manually, which often were not really fault tolerant, and we had formatting issues and copy paste issues and stuff like that. And it also consumed a lot of time, so it was really annoying to do. And as you can see, this platform really helped to streamline the whole process for us. So let's a little bit talk now about what we have actually learned in the 6 years, what we have learned by developing the tools we have today, and why we did so, and stuff like that. So one of the main central core values is that optimization is crucial. It is not something optional. You need to always optimize. We'll talk about that very shortly. So let's quickly go through this list. It is basically a high-level summary of what we have learned in the 6 years, and then we will get into detail shortly after. Another very important aspect is having motivated people. This is also something non-optional. You really need to assure that you have motivated people that are passionate about what they're doing. And if you are dealing with people, it is equally important to always be excellent to each other. We will also talk about that a little bit in depth in a couple of slides. But you really need a healthy environment, and this is very, very important. You also need clear responsibilities. So think about your responsibilities and don't overextend in early stages. What I mean by that, we'll come to that also in a couple of slides. So now let's focus on the first topic, which is optimization. Often in my career, and over again, it happens that people, or if you want to improve something and you say, oh, look at this, you really need to improve some aspects, and then you get a lot of, or a better handling of something, you get more free time, you don't need to do busy work and stuff like that. What busy work means, we'll explain also shortly, but they always say, they're too busy to improve, which is the number one biggest mistake, if I would need to name one, in my opinion. And it is really a fundamental part of every tech process, or at least it should be a fundamental central part of every development process. At the end, you need to think about it a little bit different. There's virtually never too little work, especially in the enterprise environment where you're hired to do something. There is really never a period of time where you say, oh, now I'm bored, now I can optimize. This is just not going to happen. You always have work. You should always do something. And so if you take that into account, then the only conclusion is that optimization needs to be a fundamental core value of your whole development process. And this is really important. And if you look at it like that, then you will also never say that you're too busy to optimize, because that's just a lie to yourself, and just don't do it. It's a very huge mistake. So why do we want to optimize? The primary goal is that we want to fight busy work. A busy work means like work you're doing that has no value itself. So basically, you're just doing the work to achieve something different. But to picture it a little bit, let's say we need to dig a hole, and you just have a shovel and no further tools, and you need to bring or to carry the sand a mile away or something. So at early stages, when you have no additional tools, you can just use your shovel and just walk over a mile every time you dig deeper to carry the sand over. But this is, as you can imagine, highly inefficient. You can do that at the beginning, but this whole process and just walking over and dropping a shovel full of sand is literally busy work, because it has no value. You're just doing it to achieve your final task, which is having the sand somewhere else. So this is busy work. And if you want to optimize away this kind of busy work, you would, for example, come up with a push cart where you could put in a lot of sand and just carry over tons of sand in one move. So you reduce the busy work without losing any core values. So this is super important if you want to grow. So identify and eliminate your busy work parts. But you still should always also assess your workflows. There are central parts of your workflows that have value itself. So you don't want to automate that. What I mean by that is, if we take an example in the work we do in a security team, there are central parts of our workflow, for example, the verification step, that has huge value that you do not want to lose by having it fully automated. What I mean by that is, we have a final look over, or let's get one step back. If our platform, in the to-do list of our platform, there is an entry that some package got updated, which should now carry the fix for a vulnerability. Normally, you could automate it away and automatically send, for instance, the advisory right away and stuff like that. But then you lose this core value. I'm about to explain this verification step. So we don't eliminate that part. We still verify it manually that, okay, this is really the update. There was no mistake done. The commit is inside the release and things like that. So this is core value. So this is why you need to look at your workflows and only automate where you don't lose values. We had that several times already, that some patches that needed to be backported were applied insufficiently. So basically, a fully automated process wouldn't have caught it, and we would have warned about having something fixed, which in fact was still vulnerable. So this is why some manual steps in your workflow can be good. So don't just blindly automate everything away. This also has a little bit to do with peer reviewing critical parts. We don't just manually verify it like person and then go, but we try to always peer review all the things, at least by two persons or more. This helps to catch errors that or fail or just overlooked stuff. Sometimes it happens. We are all humans. Errors can happen, and we should think about a process where we can reduce the amount of errors that could potentially happen. And peer reviewing is a really great thing to do. It also helps cross a knowledge share, and this is also very healthy for your whole process. It is also very important to document everything. So write everything down in a wiki, in a Kanban board or something like that. Even if you don't have time right now to solve all the optimization steps you have come up with, it is still important to document everything. Of course, as we have talked about it, optimization is a fundamental part of your workflow. So by documenting the results of your thoughts, of your analysis, you already did a specific part of this job. And by documenting it, you ensure that you can just pick it up and solve it later when you're able to pick up this part of your optimization and solve it. So even if you don't have time for it right now, you should always document it. This is a good thing. So this is it about optimization. We can now a little bit switch over to the human part, to motivation. Motivation is the key to success, basically for everything, and also for running a team, and fresh team. Motivation is one of the most important things. There are different kinds of motivation that we want to talk about a little bit. There is intrinsic motivation, and there is also extrinsic motivation. What I mean by that is, and you can, if you're interested in that topic, you can just look up information in the internet. There is tons of information about motivation. Intrinsic motivation, to summarize it roughly, is if you're passionate about something, if the motivation comes from within yourself, from some values, some ideas you have. Really, it boils down to having passion and being self-motivated. And contrary to that, extrinsic motivation is just that there are some goals you want to achieve, and everything else is just, yeah, you're not passionate about the thing itself, but about the goal you want to reach. For example, in a corporate environment, that would be getting a salary raise or having a title or something like that. The problem with that is that it always needs reinforcement. Shortly after you get the salary raise, this isn't enough anymore. And at one point, you want to have another dose of motivation, and then you need another salary raise. So what you really want to find is intrinsically motivated people, because they're passionate about the work and they will do everything to improve it. And this is extremely healthy for a team. So it is very tough to identify intrinsically motivated people, but is a key component if you want to have a healthy and passionate team. It is equally important to maintain motivation. So just being motivated at the beginning is not enough. You need to maintain the motivation. You need to keep being motivated. There are different ways to achieve it. It is also a very personal thing, because intrinsic motivation is personal. But you want to give utilities to people that they are able to maintain motivation. We come to that shortly when we talk a little bit about identifying responsibilities and things like that. But all that also boils down, or at least motivation is part of that, that you need to make sure that you're not burning out, or any single one of your team members is burning out. There are different ways how you could burn out. In a startup phase, and this is totally fine, it is also beneficial if you want to start establishing something, that you work like, let's say, 200%. But this can't be sustained for an extended period of time. You will burn out. So you need to identify that in time and reduce the problematic parts that would lead to burnout. Just an example about myself at the early stages. I had some scripts running to identify package updates, and basically I had an alarm clock or some kind of ring that would appear in the middle of the night when some new updates were released, so I could wake up and just enter the data in the wiki. And it was really cool. I was really passionate about doing it, about getting the information out to the users as fast as possible. And it was also, I believe, healthy for the startup phase. But you can imagine this is not something you want to do forever. This is not cool. And you need to identify it and then just solve it in a different way, which avoids people burning out. This is extremely important. If we are talking about people, another important topic is communication. So you always want to ensure that you have a friendly and respectful environment and communication. The key here is nonviolent communication, and you want to have a healthy environment that ensures it. This is also a very huge topic. You can also look up nonviolent communication. But if we want to summarize it in very small bullet points, I would say just everyone has basically needs, and you want to solve something, but you may have different point of views or different things you want to solve as your need. The problem is we are all humans, and I believe nobody really wants to fight over something or be disrespectful to something. This is just something that happens, and you need to take that into account, especially if you're dealing with text and not voice or personal discussions. Then you're also reducing some side channels. So what I mean by that is you don't have emotional layer. You can't see the expression of the other person. You also don't have maybe the voice you can use to hear out that something is meant in a joking way or something like that. If you have only text, this increases the likelihood for misinterpretation. An easy thing is just look at everything that people don't want, or people are not evil minded. People try to just get their point straight. So you should keep that in mind and don't assume people are disrespectful or something. And contrary to that, if you write some text or you communicate with someone in some different ways, always try to do it in a way that assures it could not be easily misinterpreted, and maintain a healthy environment. This is super important. It is also important to be approachable. What I mean by that is also correlates a little bit with visibility and with being friendly and having a healthy and nonviolent communication environment. You establish by that a little bit that you don't always need to run around and see where you need to poke into. I mean, to some degree, you want to do that, but you also want people to know that they can approach you and they can actively consult you when they have some new topics that should be discussed. So be approachable. This also means have clear communication channels, like select one primary communication channel, whatever that is. For us personally, it is IRC, but I'm pretty sure this wouldn't work out for other people. So just find for your environment and for your team what is an appropriate communication channel and stick to that and make it clear how you can be reached. This is very important also to a little bit implement a security-centric mindset into different teams, that they themselves take it a little bit more into account, or at least come over to you and consult you in certain aspects. It is also super important to be self-aware. What I mean by that is, and especially that applies for security, but also for everything else, it's totally okay to not know everything. Not everyone can know everything. This is literally impossible. But the problem is if you don't respect your your boundaries where knowledge about topic starts to get blurry, then this is very destructive for security and also for general tech-related topics, or in general for everything, basically. Because if you start pretending, even through you should be aware that this area starts to blur out at this point now, then this leads to problems, overlooked security implications or something like that. You want to be aware of it and then take the steps to either consult further persons who may have more knowledge in a certain topic, or at the very least educate yourself further so you can make an educated response to something. This is super important. So always be self-aware. It's totally okay to not know everything. One thing you also should think about are responsibilities. So define your core values. Think especially at the early stages. Don't try to solve everything that you come up with. Just think about what is the core value, what is the core problem you try to solve with introducing a new team. For instance, when we founded the security team, the core value was packages, and also in a very limited way. So basically just keeping track of CVEs and upstream fixes and applying those. But you can extend it. We come to that very shortly. But if you have your core values, the reason for that is that you want to avoid oversaturation. The problem is, in the early stage, let's say when we are only two people, the problem is if you want to solve everything right away and also take care of infrastructure and everything you can imagine, then you just don't have enough time to solve all the tasks, and you will miss some task, or work gets delayed, or updates get delayed, or issuing advisories get delayed. This is why you don't want to oversaturate yourself. Think about the core values and extend them later, and stick to them until you feel confident that now you can add more areas to your responsibilities before you're sure that you won't delay the work you're currently focusing on. Just don't add more responsibilities. It is also important to at this step to explore further areas. You can do that by either getting more team members, but just throwing more people onto it is not sustainable on a long shot. You want to extend your team, but still while optimizing every single point of your workflow and tooling over and over and over again. Otherwise, you are highly inefficient and you're just doing lots of busy work, and you just throw more and more people onto it, which creates other kind of problems. If you then end up with having 30 people doing busy work, this, just don't do it. Explore further areas when you get free time by optimizing or by getting one, two new members into your team. And always think outside the box. So look around you for certain topics or areas. What I mean by that is all directions basically mean, if we think about packages that we talked about, look a layer below and a layer above. Let's say if we want to look a little bit further away, a layer above it, then what does packages mean? A package is not just, or not always just, an upstream source. It can have additional content. Basically, for instance, a systemd unit file, which describes the service, and this can contain, for instance, information what user should run the service, or what kind of additional hardening this unit activates or configures. So a layer above could be hardening those unit files. Don't run services as root and you don't require. Restrict further down capabilities and other hardening ways. This is a layer above. We want to think about a layer below. A package, what does a package mean if we look deeper into it? For instance, it could be a binary, a C, C++ binary or something, which is compiled. And what does that mean? If we compile code, then we also have compiler flags and linker flags. This could be also a way of hardening your packages in revisiting the new compiler flags that you can use, Py or other kind of things. So just always look around and think outside the box, but not just for one area. If you also want to explore new areas, so look at the left and right of you. What I mean by that is go away from packages if you have enough time and think about new topics like infrastructure. Infrastructure is a totally new area you want to grow into, and this is what we did when we gained more free time that we could then invest in new work. So always be clear and explore your responsibilities when it's appropriate. Speaking about responsibilities, the current team, who is responsible for all that I described, are our six core members here. And at that point, I want to send special thanks to every single one of our team members. And I'm really proud to have such a great team, and to I'm really lucky that we managed to have such a nice team. You can really rely on every single one of the team members, and everyone is really passionate about the work they're doing. And thanks again. So if you see any one of those at a conference or something like that, send them some cheers or buy them some drinks, beer, a mate, something they like. Give something back to them. They rock. Now let's a little bit summarize what we have learned so far about everything we have talked about in this slide so far. So as a summary, and you see how passionately I also talked about my team and how proud I am. This is also because they're intrinsically motivated. They're really passionate about their work. And this is one of the key learnings. Try to find intrinsically motivated people who are really passionate about their work. This a lot cooler to work with people like that. And it is also a lot healthier, and it makes things easier to expand further areas and to evolve into something bigger and something better. So try to find cool people. Another important factor is optimization. Optimization is not optional. And don't say you don't have time for optimization, then you're doing something wrong. Always have time for optimization. It is super important. Otherwise, you will spiral down in a tech debt state, which is very tough to get out. And the further down you go, the tougher it gets to get out of it. So just don't. Always optimize. Plan in enough optimization time into your process, depending on areas, it could a little bit differ, but be clear how much time you always invest in optimization. And maintain a nonviolent communication environment. Be friendly, be excellent to each other. And if you see, things can easily get heated, especially if you're dealing only with text. Take that into account and try to de-escalate things. And we're all just humans, and we don't want to fight each other. This is really not something we should do at all. We should be friendly to each other. We should spread love. And this is also especially important for teams, for internal and external communication. Be super friendly, then people will also like to approach you from their own, and you don't need to run around and search where you need to get involved, because people like then to talk to you and to communicate with you. And always try to also de-escalate yourself and revisit a discussion. I also had it several times myself that I noticed that at one point I just misunderstood something or things like that. And at the end, it turned out that this shouldn't even have been felt like it needs to go in some kind of heated way, because it was just a miscommunication, and try to step back and look again at the information and try to bring it into a way which is friendly. This helps a lot. Also define responsibilities. Think about the core responsibilities of yours and stick to them. And when you optimize your processes, your toolings, and you get a little bit of freedom to be able to extend the responsibilities, you can think about it earlier and documented, but then only start to implement or make new responsibilities to your core values if you have really the freedom to do it appropriately. What I mean by that is, like I mentioned earlier, where you're sure that other work you already have as core responsibilities don't get delayed. It's super important. It's better to focus on something which you do appropriately than focusing on everything you can imagine and lose the value itself, because you can't sufficiently do the work anymore because it's just too much. So at that point, I want to thank everyone for listening to my talk. I hope I could get my points over to you. And if you have any questions, then feel free to ask them. I also invite you to come around and chat with our team and maybe get involved in different aspects of our distro security. We are very welcoming for everyone in our community. And at the end, this is every part of this is a community effort. So come around and think about how you can get involved if you wish to. So if you want to contact us, here are some contact information. Thanks a lot. Hope you enjoyed the talk.
All right. Welcome to the last Q&A of the day. And my name is Makilanu. My name is Marcus, and I go by Makilanu, and I have no other than Anthrax with me, and we're to do some Q&A. So let's just dive into it. Has Arch considered becoming a CVE numbering authority?
Yes, we did. So far, we just did not apply for it. So hopefully we will fix that pretty soon, because we sometimes have cases where we should get some CVE numbers ourselves. So this would aid a little bit the process of ours.
Right, sounds great. And that question was by Foxboron, by the way. Next question by Tams. Do the Arch maintainers ever manually review code? Is security a factor in deciding whether to package some software?
I guess partially it's up to the maintainers, but at the end, there is sometimes dead software, which is basically unmaintained upstreams and things like that. So we try to identify it and see if we can get rid of it. Sometimes it's challenging because you also have lots of dependencies we at least try to have an eye on it and get rid of it if it's really unmaintained and has a lot of vulnerabilities.
Right, sounds great. How do closed source proprietary packages in the community repository work, for example, Discord? Are there any special procedures with respect to security, trust, distribution for these packages?
I wouldn't say there is a very strict guideline about that, but
First, it boils down to us or being allowed to redistribute something like that. It depends a little bit also on the license of such projects and on maybe if we get an allowance to do so, which we always are very keen to ensure that this is the case. On top of that, when it comes to trust and security, this is a tough question, especially because I think open source is extremely important. So it's always like, why is the source not open? This is not good. But yeah, it boils down a little bit to if this, how widespread is the software and things like that. So right. I don't think it would make sense to just package everything.
Yes. And the next question is by the same guy as the last question, Daniel R. Parks. What does it take for a proprietary package to get included in the official repos?
Well, as mentioned, basically it boils down to licensing, if we are allowed to or we have an allowance to do so. And yeah, just have some sanity checks on if we really want to package proprietary software and is it really an established software in terms of is it widespread? So this at least gives some indications about if it's trustworthy or not.
Also, you can vote on your package's right to get them accepted and stuff like that. Next question by U1106. Is there a fixed rule when no ASA is done? You mentioned 6 months, but that sounded a bit like an example.
It was quite literally an example. We don't have very strict rules about that. Mostly if something just takes very, very long time, and as mentioned, the severity is not too critical that we still want to make sure to warn people about it. I guess we always have a small discussion about it, like, look, this package is fixed for a long time, so let's not issue an advisory or something. So there's no strict rule. We basically decide case by case.
Yes. Next question by Oak. What software do you use for the security tracking workflow? And by workflow there, he means the security tracking and finding and patching.
For tracking itself, we now have our central platform, but this right now, at least, just a part of the whole workflow, because we also need the information to be pulled out somewhere, like NIST or Mitre or something like that. Right now, this is one case where we are right now optimizing and having it more streamlined, better integrated. Currently, it's more like security team members are responsible to fetch themselves the information, get updated about new CVs and all the information and append it to our platform, our security tracker. But we have identified this is the current pain point of our whole workflow. So we are right now started to basically get it addressed and have automatically pulling in data from various sources. I think that hopefully answers the question.
Yes. Next question by Alcazar 79. Is it part of the security team's mandate to verify the security fixes, or is that an individual package maintainer's responsibility?
Well, I pretty much hope that the package maintainers themselves also validate it, but it also depends on what means validating. A package maintainer ensures, for example, some patches get applied or something. But as mentioned also on slide 14, I think, we still have a verification process that we really try to ensure. We as a security team, that we really try to assure that certain patches, certain fixes were backported into a package. Because sometimes errors can happen and patches not properly applied or something like that. So we try to always have an eye on it and verify that it indeed got fixed. Sometimes there are cases when we have some reproducers that we also throw those against a fixed version and see if we can still trigger something. So yeah, we do it manually. Yeah. Good.
Okay, next question by Hoyt. Does Arch Linux have any paid staff? If yes, how many? And where does that money come from?
No, not at all. So basically, we're all volunteers. Just free time for every one of us. Yeah, so we don't have any paid staff. But yeah, our income is basically from donations.
Yes.
So if you like our project, please donate.
Go get some merch. They so the next question by Arch Guest. Concerning Arch infrastructures, mirrors, archlinux.org, etc. How is the security handled in there? Pen tests, vuln assignment?
Well, there are different aspects, and this is an area we are shortly now, or since a little bit already involved there. And we, well, basically, there's some stuff that the DevOps team itself is also doing, like monitoring known issues that are affected by packages we have installed on our own infra, which is by pulling out the data of our security trackers and do timely updates on that. We also actively say like, oh, we need to update our machines because like, for instance, some nasty kernel issue got fixed or something else. On top of that, we also review infrastructure related things. But this is a little bit like, where basically the work of the DevOps team and the work of the security team is overlapping. So it is also a responsibility of the DevOps team, but we of course help to try to review configuration, try to review design choices, and also actively try to find vulnerabilities in our servers. So yeah.
Right. So the next question is from several people, Diabonus, Griel, and others. How can you get involved with in the Arch Linux security team?
That's a good question. I think at the last slide of mine, I've shown some channels where you can get in touch with us, most notably the IRC at hashtag Arch Linux minus security, where we are basically always hanging around. So the first thing that comes to mind is finding CVEs or known vulnerabilities that we did not track in our tracker yet. Also maybe try to review something. We basically always post our advisories beforehand. So this could also be something just looking over it, if the data inside it is looks good, if the patches we mention are the ones that really affect this this problem. And also sometimes filing bugs to our package maintainers to get some stuff sorted out. So I think it's easier just dropping by in the IRC and trying to find information that we don't already track. This would be a first good first entry point.
Yeah, the IRC is a great start to great place to start. So the next question by archconf53. Can you talk a bit more about the API for the security tracker? Where is it? Is it publicly available or only for the security team internally?
No, it's publicly available. I guess we could optimize having a proper documentation on it, because I think we basically lack proper API documentation. But what you can do is either append /json or .json to basically all the endpoints. Like if you open the index page or like you open a CVE entry and you just add a .json at the end, then you get everything in JSON formatted way, which should be very easy to write tools to consume the data. But this is also something we have documented in our issues. We really should have proper API documentation, which we currently lack, unfortunately.
Yes. So the next question is from Codin Alt. And that's basically how you identify burnout.
I guess that's a super tough question, and that could be a whole talk on its own. I also wouldn't say like I'm an expert in identifying burnout or something, because it's also a very personal thing mostly. It also depends on a little bit what kind of work or what kind of part of a workflow starts to frustrate a person. This could vary a little bit. Of course, there are things which is common, like oversaturation, which I also talked about, which you always want to avoid. If people are highly oversaturated, this will definitely lead to burnout. But it's very tough to identify. I mean, if people are highly oversaturated, they either can recognize that themselves, or sometimes people can also from the outside recognize it and try to make people aware of that and help them in some ways. But mostly, if it's not very obvious, it's very personal. And I think this is a point where every single one of us need to work on that ourselves, because we burn out. It's mostly personal things that we are annoyed about. So we should ourselves somehow create awareness of what leads to burnout in our case.
Right. So the last question is from Inikitenko. Sorry if I pronounced that wrong. What are typical vulnerabilities? And what are the sources? New users or everyone?
So typical vulnerabilities could be, for instance, denial of service problems in applications, which basically means if you can crash the application or make it misbehave or something, which makes it basically unusable, this would be one example, or more several things like remote code execution, which means if you have a service or something like that, which is network facing, then sending some specially crafted content to a service can lead to basically giving the attacker the control to execute custom code. And by that, they can take over the system and exfiltrate data and stuff like that. These are some vulnerabilities. There's a lot of different classes of vulnerabilities. Mostly, I would say they affect all users if they're inside a package or something. But it could also be that it only affects old users and not new users, for example, if a fix was applied to a package, because, for instance, directory mode or something like that, then it may be that the package, when you update it, it does not get the new modes applied. So this could be one example, but this should be a shortcoming in the package update itself. So basically, it should heal itself, especially when it's security related. I hope that kind of answers the question.
Yeah, so that wraps up this Q&A. Thank you for answering the questions.
Sure, very welcome.